Welcome to the Autism Roundtable. I'm Leah Gross, founder of Circle Care Services. I'll bring you autism experts from all kinds of fields for helpful parenting ideas, insights, and strategies. Tune in for learning and support and connection. Hello, and welcome, Dina Kelly. You come with amazing experience. I am so excited and really looking forward to all the information that you have to share. Can you please introduce yourself? Tell us a little bit about your background and what you have to bring to the autism community.
Sure. Thank you for having me here today. I actually landed in feeding completely by accident. So I was completing a graduate program in clinical psychology. I was preparing to get my LPC license and just work as more of like a play therapist for children, and ended up at an autism clinic. It had an intensive feeding program. And even though I knew nothing about it, I opted into that program for my internship. And I learned so much that semester that I said, this is what I want to do. And this is the path I need to go down. So I ended up staying in feeding. I grew really professionally in there, implementing all these ABA techniques. So after having my LPC, then decided I needed to get a BCBA so I could also keep continuing on this feeding journey. So went back and got the BCBA. And now I have both of those certifications, which I think really benefit the implementation of feeding therapy. So can bring in the clinical psych component as well as the ABA component to really be able to hone in on the concerns that surround a lot of families with feeding and be able to help them treat that.
It's such a fascinating topic. Feeding, it comes across my doorstep all the time as an occupational therapist and in running my ABA company. So it's amazing to have someone with such great background that could talk to it from different sides. So that I'm really, really looking forward to this. Okay, so tell us a little bit about what comes across your doorstep on a regular day and what you're, you know, what you're treating and how parents that are possibly struggling with feeding issues could look for help and get help.
So there's a lot of different types of kiddos that are coming across the door as having feeding challenges. So it can range anything from a neurotypical child, so a child that doesn't have any other diagnoses, anything else going on, but is really struggling with feeding, with expanding that diet, with getting in a good variety and volume of food. I will have children that will come in that are more in that medically complex component. So whether they were premature and maybe missed the opportunity to learn how to bottle feed or how to start spoon feeding and are now really struggling to either get off the tube that they were once on or really be able to gain oral intake outside of a supplement or formula type of situation. And then a good number of my children are on the autism spectrum or any sort of neurodivergency. So we see a lot of like the ADHD as well, a lot of social anxiety kiddos that are coming in. And those ones are usually, you know, struggling with different textures, different smells, a lot of the sensory factors that go into food and mealtime, is a lot of the kids that are coming, and struggling. And some of them have struggled from the beginning. And some of them parents will say they were a really, really good eater until they were about two. And then
yes,
all of a sudden,
I hear this all the time. Yes.
Everything stopped. And, you know, it's interesting because I think there's two reasons as to why that happens, right? So one can be if the child also has an autism diagnosis, usually around two is when that's coming to a head. So that's when families are getting that diagnosis. They're running around to different therapies. They're trying to figure out where to start, what to do. And so there's a lot more chaos and a lot less structure in the home. And so that can lead to some food challenges and potentially unseen food challenges because there's all these other, you know, bigger picture type things that the family might be working on. The other reason that, you know, is actually developmentally appropriate is usually around 2 years old is when children are developing their own autonomy and realizing that they're not just, you know, a part of their parent and that they are their own person. And they get to figure out that cause and effect game, right? So I do this and then this happens. And so a lot of that can come from food. I take this bite of food and I throw it on the ground, right? And if I do that enough times, then I get out of the high chair and I get to go play. Or I do that and the strawberries that I'd rather have come on my plate instead. And so sometimes inadvertently, while we're just trying to feed our kids and survive life, we end up teaching some cause and effects of certain behaviors lead to the thing that they're looking more for.
So that's fascinating. So because I do hear this a lot from parents, like, oh, he was so typical. He was eating everything. And then at 2, 2.5, 3, we actually recently had a mom on this podcast who described exactly that. He was fine. He was eating his organic. He was doing everything. And then at 2.5 is where we really saw it come out. So you would say developmentally, that might be appropriate. And that's where we might see the behaviors kicking in. What kind of things would you tell mom at that 2, 2, 3-year-old stage to really focus on, and what maybe tips could we give mom to help manage the behavior piece and almost maybe not, you know, feed into helping develop the behavior?
Yeah. Yeah. And that can be tricky, right? Because when you have a kiddo that has been eating blueberries for 2 years or 3 years, and then you go to give them blueberries and they start spitting them out or throwing them off of the tray. As a parent, your first response is, something must be wrong, right? Or let me get them something, you know, maybe they're just not in the mood for blueberries today. And so it's quick and easy as a one-off type of situation to question what might be going on. But then as you see it continue as a pattern and you recognize like, oh, they're really starting to limit some of these foods, is you want to be able to do your best to maintain foods within each food group, because that's one of the biggest things that we see from restrictive eaters is that they start to cut out full food groups. So parents will say, my child doesn't eat any fruit, or my child doesn't eat any vegetables or whatever, or proteins, meats. And they're cutting out full food groups. And so you really want to be able to try to hone in on holding on to some of those foods that they were eating, kind of setting those boundaries for mealtime, similar to how we set boundaries for other types of activities in the toddler's day that they may have to do that they don't always like doing. So it could be the same as like brushing your teeth or buckling in the car seat or crossing the road in a, you know, a busy street, right? There's certain things that as parents, we have to set boundaries for our toddlers to be able to make sure that we keep them safe. And so really food ends up falling in that same category that we want to make sure that we honor some preference and some choice, but that at the same time, we're saying we do need to actually eat. And so we have to hold some of those boundaries around mealtime to get that consumption in.
Okay, and what, like, boundaries would you be speaking about? Like, what kind of, like, okay, I'm a mom with a 2-year-old that's, you know, dumping and not eating, and he's only eating a slice of pizza a day if I cut it up in little pieces and run after him. So what kind of solutions would you give such a mom? Or is that, let's start with solutions, and then I would love to talk about the topic of, at what point do we go to a feeding therapist? But let's first give some solutions to that 2-year-old mom that I hear all the time.
Yeah. Well, so first and foremost, thinking about it from more of a prevention standpoint, right? And that antecedent that we talk a lot about from behavior analysis and with families is thinking about how do we avoid getting to that point of that amount of particularness, right? And that's being able to be as cognizant of it as we can in the beginning. And there's a lot of jokes and memes and things in moms groups about talking about how, right, you have to stand on your head and spin in 3 circles for your child to take the bite of pizza that's cut in the shape of a star, right? And so you're doing these silly things, but I say, that child was eating that pizza 6 months ago. And now we're at this point where we're dancing on our head and we're doing all of these things. So thinking about some of that prevention standpoint is really being able to make sure when we talk about setting that boundary is that you're teaching what the actual cause and effect is with eating. So we need to take our bite and we can play, or mommy will sing you that song, or you can see mommy spin on her head and be silly, right? But the bite comes first. Because what often happens is as families, we engage in all of these types of activities and then the kid still doesn't end up taking the bite. And so we say, we've done all these things and we can't get him to do it. And my response to that is, right, because you gave it all to him already. So why does he need to take that bite? And so I look at it in reverse of we save all the things that they are looking for after they complete that bite, then we can give them all of those things that we're looking for. And so flip-flopping what a lot of families are doing, because inadvertently, as parents, we end up reinforcing the opposite of what we want our child to do. So when the child is usually eating well and doing a good job and sitting there and taking their bites, as parents, we might be attending to another child. We might be washing the dishes. We might be preparing lunches for school, right? We have a lot of things that we're doing. And as long as our kiddo is eating, we're good, right? When that child starts throwing food or yelling or squishing it all on the high chair, then what do you do as a parent? You come back over to that child. Now you're going, oh, nope, we don't do that. Let's take our bites and let's do our stuff. And so do you want to sing a song while we take our bites? And so all of a sudden, all of that refusal behavior for those bites is now getting mom to come back. Mom's paying attention to me. Mom's singing a song. Mom's doing all of these things. And that's how I get her attention. And so we have to be able to really look at it in the opposite effect of we want to be able to see take that bite, and then we do all of that fun engagement. And so when that child is eating well, you want to be able to give them the things that they're looking for. Sing that song while they're eating, as long as they're doing it, you know, give them the high fives, even if you're packing lunches and doing other stuff.
Yeah. And as a mom myself, I could say that, like, we definitely associate feeding with nurturing and giving love to our children. And when we are distracted, we have a lot of things going on, which is the nature of our lives. You know, when the child calls and says, you know, I need you, mommy, to come pay attention to me, we almost have like this like guilty feeling of like, okay, let me shove it all in your face. Let me do whatever you want me to do. And then like go back. So it is a nice idea to like stop and really think about making sure that we're showing our love in the right way instead of just absolutely. Like throwing that attention.
Absolutely. And that's what's hard, is because you're absolutely right. There's just a lot of emotion that surrounds mealtime and eating, because for a lot of us that actually love and enjoy eating, it's emotional. It's a connection. It's an opportunity. You know, most people don't just get together to sit and stare at each other and hang out, right? When you're going to hang out with friends, you're meeting up at a restaurant or at a bar, somewhere where you're getting food and drink to share amongst each other while you're having that conversation. And so to think about somebody in your life that's not enjoying food in that same way, it's very odd. And so we push as parents to go, don't you love that? Don't you enjoy eating those bites of food just as much as I do? And sometimes for some of our kids, especially if they really have that ARFID diagnosis, that real feeding disorder diagnosis, is they may not have that internal drive and interest in food the way that most of us do. And so that's where a lot of my training comes into, pulling some of that emotion out of mealtime and not bringing in the, you're going to love this, you're going to want to eat this. And it's more of, we have to find foods that you're, you know, able to work with, because we have to get them in your body because they're the fuel for you to survive. If you love them along the way, that's awesome. But we need you to be able to accept them, you know, and tolerate them, and not all of them, but enough that you're, you know, getting in a good variety and volume of foods to work through. But it's really hard not to bring all of that emotion and attachment that we mostly have to food to the toddler table for that.
The table. Yeah, I was just thinking play on words right there, like not to bring the emotion to the table, which is really hard. And it is not an easy thing to do, especially as a parent. And like you said, the psychology that we have associated with food and nurturing and loving and social. And, you know, it's amazing to almost like change focus and say, hey, this child doesn't love food. So let's define what you use the word ARF is, like a feeding diagnosis really is. And when would a parent be able to pinpoint and say, my child is really struggling with food?
Yeah. So there's two main things that we would look at. So that ARFID diagnosis, which stands for Avoidant and Restrictive Food Intake Disorder, it is the actual feeding disorder that's diagnosable from the DSM, where you can actually get, you know, a insurance-based diagnosis in essence. I find usually stems from school-aged kids and up. It will say in the diagnostic criteria that it can be from infancy, but I associate ARFID similarly to if we were to say like anxiety of food, right? And so there's definitely some history of food refusal and or food trauma. Maybe a child had a choking incident or got really sick after eating something, had an allergic reaction of some kind. That can elicit this ARFID diagnosis, as well as some kids that had just have had years of avoiding these foods, and now it gives this sort of like visceral response to food and to eating. The other side of that is really looking at what people will call pediatric feeding difficulties or diagnoses. And those are the kiddos that may not necessarily have the anxiety and the history of food refusal. It's more some skill deficits with eating. So that could either be for self-feeding, the scooping or stabbing. That could be some struggling with the oral motor skills. And that can also be that typical kind of toddler refusal that we see in a lot of toddlers for a lot of activities, right? You would never know that asking your toddler to put on a pair of socks could cause like an entire meltdown, right?
Yes, I've experienced it. It's pretty amazing.
They're just, you, who knew, right? Or you say like, go wash your hands, right? After going to the bathroom. And then all of a sudden it's like, oh my goodness. And it's all of this torture. That same sort of toddler drama can be brought to mealtime. And so the same sort of thing, they just decide that blueberry is too squishy, or that pizza is too hot, or, you know, this food is too red, or whatever it might be in just their little toddler minds. And so then they start to refuse those bites of food, but they're doing it out of more of their, you know, standing their ground, because they're going to, you know, be the ones that are
self-emergent stage of like wanting to say, like, I have an opinion and I need to display it.
Yes.
But so I would say like at 2 years old or 3 years old, 4 years old, even I guess all the way up till I have 13, 14, 15 years old, we see children wanting to show that they have an opinion and they are individual people. At what point do we say, this child's not just saying, I have an opinion, and that this is truly a feeding issue, I truly am not getting my child enough nutrition? Like, where does that fine line go?
Yeah. So you're really looking at that more of restrictive eater. So you're looking for things like full food groups have been eliminated completely. You're looking at volume, that you're feeling like they're not getting in enough at each meal that they're sitting down for. Maybe they're taking like tiny little bites and then saying that they're done. That there's some challenges just coming to the dinner table. There's a lot of frustration or tantrum even just to come sit down, or as soon as they take a couple bites, then they want to be done and they want to leave. Challenging sitting around foods that they don't like to eat. So just, you know, being in the same table as somebody that's eating something, even if they're not eating it, and it's causing a lot of difficulty for them. And one of the biggest ones that falls in this diagnostic criteria for ARFID, and I use it as really my guiding criteria, is that impact on psychosocial functioning. And so that really, I'm looking at it both from the child's perspective and their surrounding family. So when I have families that come to me and say, we are so stressed, we can't go to the zoo for the day. We certainly can't go on vacation. We can't go do these things because if I don't have the Red Bull with the green applesauce from the squeezy pouch in that bowl for my child to eat, you know, and there's all of these rules and guidelines and such limited and restricted intake for that child, that that's like the biggest red flag for me, is that it's impacting the family, it's impacting the child. You know, I've had kids that will go sit in the nurse's office during lunchtime at school, just to avoid being part of mealtime. I've had families that avoid going to other kids' birthday parties because they're embarrassed that their kid will just run around the room and doesn't want to actually sit there and eat the nuggets or the pizza that somebody is having at that party. So that's one of the biggest things, is that impact on that psychosocial functioning. But the little things as parents that you also can look at are that restriction in variety and volume of food, and the types of behaviors surrounding mealtime.
Wow. Wow. That's great. That's amazing. Now, at what point do we know, pretty much what I'd like to ask is, there are certain diagnoses that a child physically is having a hard time eating. What might we have to rule out before we go towards a behavioral approach? Like, there's definitely, I've come across children who actually can't chew, can't swallow. Or like you mentioned, like had a traumatic event related to food. So what should a parent rule out medically before going to a behavioral approach for feeding?
Absolutely. So, you mentioned a good one, the chewing component. And so that's definitely something you want to be able to first see, what textures is that child able to manage. So if they've only been drinking from a bottle and eating applesauce, we can't start them on a chicken nugget because maybe we don't know if they actually can chew that type of food. Or even if they are eating some regular textured foods, you want to be able to look and see, how are they actually managing that? I have some kids that have just learned to swallow food whole. And that's not great from a safety perspective. And it's also not really great from a digestion perspective. So we really want to make sure from an oral motor standpoint that they're good. And it doesn't mean, even if they're not great, in the sense that you would even say we can't do regular texture now. What we can do is look at even pureeing a variety of different foods. So while they're working with a professional on the oral motor skill component, is that you could still be working on introducing some more variety and volume of flavor of food, so that when they are able to chew, you can take the pureed peanut butter and jelly sandwich and now make it a regular peanut butter and jelly sandwich. But the pureed version would get you the same intake. It would, for calories and all of the nutrients, it would taste very similar. It's very odd if you've never had pureed peanut butter and jelly. I do have to say that, as weird as it is, once you put it in your mouth and you're moving it around, is that you go, tastes like I just chewed up a peanut butter and jelly sandwich. And so you're getting the flavor component for the child, and you're getting the nutrition intake for that child, while at the same time working on building up their muscles in their mouth so that they can actually manage that regular textured food. For any kids where they may have had any sort of reaction, you want to always be able to rule out any potential food allergies that could be coming, if that was an area of concern with any of the foods that you had introduced. We also have children, and it's really common, especially in the autism community, to have a lot of constipation. And when a child is constipated, usually it is paired with their diet and what they're eating. But it's really hard to work on introduction of new foods at the same time that child is dealing with constipation. because you're already uncomfortable. And so I will tell families that, you know, if there's any issues with constipation, if they've already been on Miralax or something along those lines, or they've had to go to the hospital to get an enema or any of those sorts of things, is that we want to be able to have that cleared and feel good before we then start fresh with some introductions of some new foods.
Yeah. And I see in my practice a lot of children with constipation, and it's almost chicken before the egg, egg before the chicken, because if a child is not eating all their food groups, so then their body can't void properly, and then they get so clogged up that they don't want to put anything in.
Exactly.
So it's really important to address feeding issues, because I mean, it's really a child's a whole picture, obviously, and it's something we have to look at holistically. But definitely I've seen that. I've had children in the therapy room, like literally bent over with like, and mom will tell me he has avoided in a week and 2 weeks, right? So that is really, really difficult. And then obviously, then we're going to have an aversion to food, because I don't want to put anything in if it's not coming out.
Exactly. It's not comfortable, right? And so we have to be able to find that balance of either getting it cleared first or talking with the GI about what they recommend as far as some intake. Sometimes it's just as simple as increasing some water intake. We have a lot of kids that either don't drink at all or revert to things like milk or formula. And that can also, you know, impact that constipation. And so by actually getting in some more water or doing things like applesauce or, you know, pureed pears or things like that can sometimes be a little bit easier to tolerate, but also then help move through that constipation component so that you can get to more of those other foods that you want to try.
Amazing. Okay, so I would love to talk about the different methods of feeding therapy. So when I was an occupational therapist working back in Children's Specialized Hospital, I touched on feeding a little bit, and I think you will probably have the better terminology for me, but we went from a sensory approach where we would introduce the child to the food. They would only be in the room for a couple minutes, and then they would smell it, and then they would touch it, and then they would lick it, and then right each session, session by session, we would slowly introduce it. And I would think sometimes we landed up being successful and the child would actually chew it and swallow it, but it was definitely a struggle. It was not an easy place to be. And then I ended up specializing more in like the sensory component, because I think I threw my hands up in the air in feeding. So kudos to you that you're still in it. So give us some of your tricks and tell us what different methods there are out there for feeding and what you've found to work best.
Yeah. So if you search feeding therapy on the internet, which a lot of parents do, there's two main approaches that you will come across. So there is more of that sensory-based approach, which is what you were talking about, and then this behaviorally-based approach. So that sensory-based approach really does look at immersing yourself within the food. So experiencing all of the senses that come with eating. So that smell it, look at it, touch it, poke it, right? Bring it up, put it to your lips, maybe lick it, see if you can actually get them to put it in and chew it, and then often spitting it out, right? And being able to try to see if that will lead to more acceptance of foods. From a behaviorally based approach, what I look at is really looking at that consumption of food, because at the end of the day, that's what families are looking for. From a feeding therapy program, we're looking for that child to actually increase their consumption of food, to be able to hit on those things that they're concerned about from a nutrition standpoint, from a social standpoint, all of those sorts of things. So when I think about the sensory approach and we look at all of those components with food, is that to me, it looks more like we're having sort of like sensory play, right? So the same way when you have like a bucket of the rice and you let the kid put their hands in it, or shaving cream, and they get to play, and you're building up their acceptance and their tolerance of those different types of feelings and smells and experiences for them. But I hear from families all the time that they spend a lot of time and a lot of effort and money in those types of programs where it feels more play-based, because it is more play-based, but it doesn't lead to the actual consumption of the food. An example that I share a lot, and I share for a lot of families to think about, is the food of raspberries, right? So I love raspberries. I go through pints of raspberries a week, which is really unfortunate now that berries are very expensive. But I will sit with a bowl of raspberries while I'm working and pop
good antioxidants going on right there.
Yeah, absolutely, right? But pop them in and eat them and enjoy them and really, you know, don't even think anything of it. I really just enjoy having my bowl of raspberries as a snack. If I was told to sit with the raspberry, right, and hold it in my hand and look at it closely, you start to see that there's like little hairs, or I don't know what we would call them, fibers, right, that flap in the wind on the side of raspberries. There's also a lot of little ridges and bumps, and some of them are softer and some of them are harder and some of them are wet looking, right? And sometimes if you start to squeeze the raspberry, it has some little juice that pops down, right? If I have to immerse myself in all of the sensory components of the raspberry, I no longer actually want to eat that raspberry. I've thought about it too much. I now don't want to actually eat the hairs and the bumps and all of the things.
We dissected this too much that it became unappealing.
Right. And now I'm done and I no longer want to eat it. And I think inadvertently that happens sometimes within that sensory-based approach is you could teach me then to start squishing and playing with the raspberry as an activity, but you've now made it less interesting for me to actually put inside my mouth. And so when I come at it from a behaviorally based approach, you don't have to smell it. You don't have to look at it. Let's just stab it, pop it in, chew and swallow, and then gain access, you know, to all of that fun and be able to ultimately be done and get down and go do the things that you would rather do. So it's less about focusing on the sensory components of the food and more about that consumption of the food.
Okay. And in like, okay, so I feel like we got a good picture of what the sensory component of the food is. And not to say that it's not a good method. It is a great method. I'm actually going for my BCBA now. So I'm originally an occupational therapist and now I'm going for my BCBA. And I did one of my original reports, you know, that we had to come up with like a research question. And as an occupational therapist, I was like, okay, let's look into the feeding side of things. And I used that. And like I said, there's been great results with that. But then when I was looking at the research, it seems to be that there's a lot more data on the behavioral approach working, and that
for that research, when compared to the sensory approach, the behavior approach is coming out much more effective and efficient.
Yeah. I was a little insulted when I did the research, but data speaks for itself, because I was like, I love being an OT and I love working in the sensory space. But really, the data is showing that the behavioral approach is that much more effective.
When it comes to food, right? So, you know, and that's the part to think about too, right? Is like there is absolutely an opportunity for sensory experiences with kids to be able to enhance, you know, a lot of
yes. Specifically to this, yes, for sure. Occupational therapy is great and I love occupational therapy and I'm still practicing occupational therapy. I'm not I'm not saying anything bad about it. I'm saying in the space of feet and we help so many children to be able to do things that they wouldn't be able to do. Respond vestibularly to things, be able to have experiences that they weren't willing to. Yes, so for the sensory component and being able to handle different environments, yes, sensory is amazing. And also for the core strength, very important, which we're going to talk in a couple minutes about the different disciplines that you work with as well. And OT, right, we need to have a strong body and a strong mouth in order to be able to chew. And so there's definitely space in this world for occupational therapists, and they really help our children very much in the autism community as well. But in feeding, the research is showing that the behavioral approach is being is definitely sort of more of the gold standard, and we're seeing better results. So what are we seeing in, like, what does the behavioral approach mean? How would a parent go ahead and be educated in that area?
Sure. So it definitely depends on the age of the child, you know, the years of history that that child has had with food refusal. But it really comes down to going back to what I was talking about before, is finding the opportunity to set a bigger circle of a boundary of we have to be able to eat, while then still being able to respect and, you know, offer the opportunity for preference, because we all have preferences, right? So I can't just say, you must eat all of these bites all the time perfectly, because that's not the reality for anybody. I think even people that would consider themselves great eaters have a list of foods that they're just not that interested in eating, and that's okay. But with my, you know, little bit older kiddos, so, you know, school age, even higher preschool and up, we do a lot of food sorting. So, you know, even before we would start a program, we would look at, you know, let's look at some pictures of food if they're not even reading yet. And let's put them into some different categories of, you know, I think I might try that. I'm not really too sure about that, right? And being able to see where they put some foods. And right off the bat, a lot of families are really surprised with how their kids sort, because they'll say, oh, all of their foods are going to go in not trying that category. And surprisingly, a lot of them don't. You know, once that child is sitting and looking at the foods and thinking about foods, even if they've been refusing them for the parents, as they go to start to sort those foods, they do have foods that maybe they've seen their friends at school eat, or maybe they've seen one of their siblings eat, and they're like, oh, I could maybe try that if I wanted to. You know, and so we do a lot of opportunities to give them that control and give them that preference of where are we going to start with some of those foods, because it's not a choice to say nothing. But at the same time, I want you to be able to guide the choices that we're making as far as that food introduction goes.
Which I love, because I know that ABA therapy really has a bad rap for being so rigid and, you know, Pavlov and, you know, yep. and we've gotten such a bad, I mean, I don't know why, because now in the field, when I see the children, that's not what we do. But it really does have like that rep for being so rigid. And
the internet doesn't delete anything. So the internet can't have the whole thing there.
But like, it's amazing that the first thing that you said when talking about behavioral therapy with feeding is we have to look at the child's preferences. So I love that. And I really do feel that that's 2025 ABA, which is that we are looking at the child, and this is child-centered care. This is care that where we're looking and we're saying, what have you been exposed to? What is something that you would pick? And then we're working off of what the child's preferences are. So sure. That's amazing.
And starting small, you know, and I think we'll get into this. I know you wanted to talk more about like some of the things that families can do, but in thinking about, you know, where do you often start with the behavioral approaches? I look at what are they currently eating and what can be a small variation off of that to be able to challenge them. So, you know, even something as silly as you have a child that only eats goldfish, we're going to try a Cheez-It just because it's still a cheesy cracker and a crunchy thing, but it pushes a little bit out of that small safe circle that they've been sitting in with the goldfish, but it doesn't challenge them from goldfish to broccoli, which I always use broccoli. Broccoli gets such a bad rap, but I have to tell you, broccoli by far, if I could have all of my kids that I've ever worked with line up and line up vegetables, broccoli absolutely comes in the top 1 to 3 for almost every kiddo that eats the food. So broccoli gets a really
okay. What
bad
are the
rap,
other three? Just give us some practical ideas of other things that work for kids. What are the other three? What are your top three vegetables that you you see children actually do consume?
Yeah, so broccoli is definitely a big one. I would say carrots is another really good one, and or like a sweet potato type of a thing. What would be the third one? It's hard. I think once kids are actually eating things like peas and corn and green beans are all fairly doable. I think kids struggle more when there's more what we call like response effort to eat the food. So things like asparagus is harder because you're having to like really crunch down on it. Things like zucchini is harder because it has that skin on the outside. Similar to like the green bean and the peas, like I don't often start with those vegetables because they also have that skin on the outside. And so a child usually starts by over chewing. And then they're left with just the skin in their mouth, and that's kind of funky.
There's a lot of texture. There's a lot of textures involved in each one of those that you just mentioned. Yeah. Like there's like two textures.
Carrot is a really good one, because it's consistent and it's can be really soft. And that's where broccoli, I think, you know, again, even though it gets that bad rap, it's all like one piece and you can chew it for, you know, if you steam it nice and soft, like you can chew it all in one piece. You're not left with, you know, any random pieces of skin or bean or something like that inside your mouth.
Amazing. Okay, so I'd love to shift to the different professionals that you work with that come into the feeding space. So what professionals would a parent that is struggling with feeding reach out to, and why?
So, I mean, I definitely, for me, I would recommend the feeding therapist first because they can help in that sense of directing you to the other specialties that you might need in that space. But there's a lot that I work with as far as we look at OT, like we were just talking about with OT. One of the important things for children, if they're going to eat, is they need to be able to sit up straight. It's actually why I will often use a feeding seat or put even a kiddo that might have already been moved out of the high chair back into a high chair for feeding initially, because it gives more of that stability for their body. But they need to be able to have that core strength of sitting up so that they can appropriately chew and swallow that food. And so
I love that you're touching on that, because I do think that environment for feeding is also like super important. And exactly that, if the child can't move his hands freely in order to get to the food, or the child's on a slump and his esophagus is to the side, then taking down the food is difficult. So
yeah, like, so they've got to be able to sit up straight. If we're looking at a kiddo that's struggling with self-feeding, the first thing that I will look at is, what does their grip strength look like? What does their eye-hand coordination look like? Because you don't realize how much work goes into the actual act of getting the food from the plate into your mouth. And so, you know, for some kids, it might just be that they didn't feel like eating because they had a parent that was feeding them, and they do have all of those strengths and abilities. And for some kids, they don't. They struggle to hold the spoon or the fork the right way, or they're always missing their mouth, or the food's falling off before it gets up to their mouth. And so those are things that I've worked with OTs that they can actually build that up outside of mealtime, so that they're not working directly with food, but that they can build up those muscles to be able to, in turn, improve that feeding therapy experience. With speech, you know, it's interesting. The same muscles that we have in our mouth to chew are the same ones that we use to speak. And so if we're struggling in the chewing department, we're probably also having a speech delay. So usually most of those kids are already paired with a speech therapist. But they can often work a lot on chewing effectively, those oral motor skills, being able to have an effective swallow, and make that feeding experience the best that it can be.
Yeah. And I had mentioned that I have children of my own. So my second daughter, she was like very low muscle tone. She does neurotypical child, but very, very low muscle tone child as a baby. And I remember when she was learning to eat, the chewing of the meat was so hard for her. And she would try and try, and she had that low muscle tone in the mouth, and her mouth just did not support the chewing. And till this day, she's strong enough to chew meat, but till this day, she associated the difficulty of chewing with the meat. She still won't eat meat. Now she's like 13 years old. And she's capable of it. She's playing basketball. She's dancing. She's fine. But sometimes I think we do see that when there are areas of difficulty within feeding, such as swallowing, such as sitting, such as self-feeding using the forks, and then it's so difficult, then we're like, hey, this is just too hard. I'll choose something else. I'll go to what's easier. So that's also something for parents to think about.
And those muscles in our mouth are really the same as the muscles in every other part of our body. And so I tell people all the time, if you're not using them effectively and consistently, they're not going to function in the way that you want to do them, right? We all have muscles in our body that if we trained effectively, we could run a marathon, right? But I can tell you that I today could not run an entire marathon, right? Even though I have the capability to make it happen if I trained effectively for it. And so I look at chewing really as training for a marathon for families, you know, especially where kids are struggling with it, is, you know, they cannot go from not chewing at all to eating a whole sandwich or to eating 5 chicken nuggets. Like it's just not going to happen. It's like taking a couch potato and telling them to run a marathon. They can't do it, but they can train slowly for it. So I've had some families where, you know, if we're working on chicken nugget, they're going to puree most of that chicken nugget because we want to be able to get it in at the, you know, response level that they can do. But maybe we have 3 of the bites that the child's practicing. And once they're getting more efficient with chewing those, we make it, you know, more bites of regular texture, less bites of puree to be able to help them build up and train ultimately their mouth to run the marathon of eating a regularly textured.
Yeah. Yeah. So aside from the occupational therapist, the speech therapist, who else might a parent encounter in the medical world?
GI, for sure. And a lot of families are already connected with GI by the time they find me too. But we're looking at GI sometimes from an allergy standpoint. Sometimes some of the allergies present as GI concerns. And so they're usually paired for that. We also will have GI from a constipation standpoint, for sure, kids that are struggling in that area. And oftentimes kids that are just struggling with their intake are paired with GI potentially for needing a feeding tube or something like that, depending on the severity of their refusal. And then the last one would be a nutritionist. So sometimes if I have a child that's coming to me that is on a tube and their job, or they want to get off of that tube, or a kiddo that's been kind of threatened in the medical land of a tube is coming, and we want to try to avoid having to go down the route of the tube, is that I will pair with a nutritionist to be able to say, all right, here's the height and weight of the child. Here's what they're currently taking in for an oral intake. And what do we have to like aim for? What is the goal to be able to have them continue to grow and either be able to get rid of that tube or not need that tube? And so, you know, we'll bring in that expertise from that standpoint as well.
Amazing. Okay, so next topic I'd love to discuss is you come with like 2 amazing backgrounds. You have the psychology and the feeding. So you get to see the struggles that parents have and children are having through the day. It is very emotional for the parent. It is a difficult road to go down when my child is refusing food. A, is it normal to feel bad, emotional around it? And what kind of thoughts could a mom shape, you know, give herself some support with?
Yeah. So yes, is the answer. There are so many emotions that come around feeding. And when I have families that come to me, you know, I always laugh and say, you ride a roller coaster because you go from sad to mad to angry to just giving up, right? And getting frustrated. And so you run kind of this circle to then sometimes happy because then they take that bite, right? And you get to have some of that relief. You ride a whole ride of emotions when it comes to feeding. And that's why, you know, I go back to that idea of part of what I try to work on with families is lessening a lot of that emotion that comes into mealtime. Because when the child is heightened and then we get ourselves heightened, all we're doing is keeping our child up in that heightened state. And so I tell parents that we can't control where the child is, but what we can do is control where we are. And so as parents, we have to remain in that state of calmness and neutrality when it comes to that mealtime, so that even though the child's having a tantrum up here, if you can remain down here, is that ultimately they will come down and meet your energy. And that's so hard for families to do. It's so hard for families.
Yeah, you want to give me some tips on how to do that? Because I can't say in my life, I never get to the high place when all, I have six children, when all six are, you know, asking for something and I'm really up there. Or imagine, you know, sometimes we have these, you know, children that are displaying really extreme behaviors. Like, how could I center myself? What is a good way to self-regulate myself emotionally to bring myself down so that then my children can mirror that?
Yeah. Yeah. And I think that answer really differs person to person, right? Because everybody's going to have a different way on how they do it. You know, for me personally, I have two kids. Not six like you, but I have two. And that's hard enough for me.
Yeah, so it gets busy. There's a lot involved.
But even with two, right? So I almost look at it for me as, you know, I could be going about my regular day. And if my child is having some issues, that I go into a role. And so I look at it as, oh, I've got to turn on, right, this role to be able to follow through for my child in this moment. So do I need to remain calm? You know, do I need to center myself? I start thinking about things that aren't emotional at all. So I start thinking about, like, what do we have going on tonight? Or what did I need to get at the grocery store? Or maybe doing some math problems in my head or whatever it might be. Like, there's just some mundane things that kind of keep you, while you're there for your child and you're there to support them, you're doing things within your own head to be able to keep yourself from escalating the way they are. Because when you're escalating with them, you're actually not helping them ultimately come down. A quote I use a lot is that anxiety does not respond to reasoning. And that's what we want to do all the time. When our child is having this tantrum and we as parents are going, you know, we go again through the gamut of, it's okay, calm down, you're all right, let's look at this thing, let's do this. Or, why are you screaming? Stop screaming. You need to calm down. Right? Like, it doesn't matter whether you're trying to talk really kindly and really sweet or you're screaming at them. Either way, you're trying to reason with a child that's already heightened. It's not actually going to work. You need them to be in more of that calm space before you're going to be able to work through that. And so a lot of the work that I do with parents is in that space of remaining calm, not reacting. Because a lot of times what happens when a child's frustrated about something, let's say you put that bite of food in front of them and it genuinely is making them nervous, right? And so now they're like, oh my gosh, I don't want to take this bite of food. Instead of just sitting with that nervousness, what do a lot of kids do? They smack their parent. Right? They throw something across the room. They do something to be able to try to show this parent, I'm not thrilled right now with what you're making me do. But when they start engaging in those behaviors, what happens? A parent's going to say, stop hitting, no hitting. Now you lost your TV because you hit, right? Oh, you threw that against the wall. Now you have to go pick up the mess. You have to. And so there's all of these things that it's keeping everybody heightened. And so I look a lot to be able to go, you know, that child hits you, you might need to move, but we're not going to like allow that to get us heightened in that moment, because they're really looking for you to meet them in that heightened space. And what you're looking to be able to teach them is to come down and meet you in that calm space.
Love it. Love it. Love it. So pretty much you got to identify within yourself how to self-regulate, how to bring yourself back down.
And it takes a lot of work outside of the mealtime, right? Because you can't do it in the moment. You really have to come up with for yourself, what are you going to do when your kiddo is in that situation? Which I think is why a lot of families really like my program, is because they're given they're given rule, you know, they're actually given things to follow and guidelines to follow. And a lot of times that's what parents will say. That's all I needed. I just needed somebody to tell me, do this.
Give me a little roadmap. Tell me what I'm supposed to be doing.
Yeah, because you don't know. You try all of the things. And that's what families will say. I tried this. I tried this. I tried this. And I'm like, great, but you tried them all in a 5-minute block of time, right? So we ran through the being kind, being angry, ignoring, being angry, being cut, right? And like, we're going through all of the things, and that child is still just in that heightened space the entire time. And so it takes a lot of work outside of mealtime to prep it. My best one is just to, you know, look at it as a role that you're playing, you know, when you're in that time, and try to take the, you know, emotion component out of it.
Love that. Love that. Okay. So tell us a little bit about your program that you've developed. And when I spoke with you last, you told me that it's even available via, you know,
virtual.
The web. Yeah. So tell me. Yeah. So telehealth. So it's really available to everybody. So tell us a little bit about that and how a parent could access feeding therapy.
Sure, absolutely. So yeah, I mean, a lot of times when you think about a feeding therapy program, especially if you're looking at it like you were talking about Children's Specialized Hospital or thinking about some of the other local hospitals in the area, hospital-based programs, you are having to go to that facility, oftentimes in a city, right? And usually what it looks like in the beginning is that you're bringing your child to a clinic setting. The therapists that are there are going to take that child, work with that child, and then work to be able to bring you back into that program and then be able to say, okay, so now take these things that you are doing here, and now you're going to go do them at home. And what I was kind of forced into realizing when COVID hit and we couldn't be in person anymore was really realizing that as much as it's harder in the beginning, that it has been way more effective, and parents are really loving the opportunity to be able to be with that child from the beginning. So there's no more generalization from therapist to parent, and there's no more generalization from clinic space or hospital space to back to the home. So the way that my program works is it's a lot of parent prep in the beginning to be able to talk about these ideas of how do we look at feeding? How are we going to, you know, change the way that we're addressing our child at mealtime? How are we going to change the way that we present food at mealtime? So it's a lot of prep work going into then being able to work directly with that child. But now the parent is working through that child's heightened anxiety or heightened frustration or heightened tantrum in that moment, and being able to feel really, great and confident in how to bring that child back down to a space of calm. And so then they feel really empowered to go into those mealtimes. My program is 6 weeks long, and I laugh with families often that the person that they were at the beginning versus just 6 weeks later is completely different. They leave going into outpatient sessions saying like, I've got this. I can do this. I'll only need to check in with you, you know, to see, make sure that things are going well. And so where 6 weeks ago they were saying, you know, I don't know what to do at mealtime anymore. And so it's a confidence booster for parents. The child is given boundaries and routine at mealtime, which a lot of them just strive for that structure and the routine of what is going to be expected. A lot of times with meals, it's the unknown. Families are on the go, on the run. They're throwing something in front of their kids.
Right. And children do crave structure. So by creating a structured program, sometimes we're giving them direction, and that really helps.
Yeah. So it's a lot of that within the program. Parents will often hear that it's virtual and immediately shudder and go, oh, my child, you know, won't respond virtually. And I say that that's okay. Actually, most of them end up doing, and wanting to talk with me. But my program is focused much more on the parents than the child. So even though I'm there for the child as well, my main focus is on having the parents be confident and comfortable in that mealtime to in turn make it great for that child. So I'm not, you know, trying to have your 2-year-old look at me for an hour on the screen and do direct feeding. It wouldn't work. I am there as the support for the parents to feel better going into their meal times with their kids.
You really do bring like an amazing view to feeding because of the psychology background that you're working with the parents, and then you have the ABA background with the behavior.
It's a really nice connection because, like I said, there is a lot of emotion that comes into mealtime. And so, you know, parents come to it with a lot of emotion. So we work through all of that, you know, feeling and emotion component, as well as working on the actual behavioral act of eating.
I love that view. I love it. So you brought such amazing information today. Really, really appreciate it. If you had one message to share with parents on that are working with children on the autism spectrum and are having feeding difficulties, what would that message be?
You're not alone. Is really my biggest piece to share, because I feel like oftentimes families will say they feel like they're out on an island by themselves, and all they do is see other kids that are eating other foods and doing things, and it's just their child that's not. And I wouldn't have a company if that was the case, but you're not alone. And I strive to have parents understand that, it is hard, and it does stink to go through, you know, all of this frustration with your child, especially if you're dealing with multiple doctors and multiple appointments and multiple specialties that you have to do. But feeding can absolutely be helped. It can absolutely improve. And there's a whole community of people that are in the same boat as you.
Thank you, Dina, for coming on. This was just an absolutely amazing podcast. I loved it.